Hey guys, welcome to Fitness Mentor's presentation of the online course for the ACE CPT exam. We are here going over the Chapter 16 PowerPoint. So, Chapter 16 is really going to be about the emergency procedures that you may need to go through in a gym environment or even just in a fitness setting. So, really not a ton of questions come from this chapter, but you know, there are a few that we are going to point out, as well as, you know, it's good for you to understand exactly the type of response that is necessary when someone is in trouble and or has any of these conditions that come up. So flipping over to slide number two as we scroll down. So policies and procedures regarding the gym setting. So yeah, basically we're just going to list these and kind of go through them, but you always have to have a fully stocked first aid kit with personal protective equipment for any gym. That's recommended. Know where the AED is, as well as pocket masks to ensure fast acting CPR. In the gym environment, it is more common than other places for someone to suffer a heart attack. So definitely know where those are to basically address the situation immediately. The PAR-Q, we've talked about this in previous chapters, but it's really there to identify high-risk individuals as well as determine if a client needs a medical referral or a medical release before beginning an exercise program. So yeah, keep that in mind. Always perform that on all clientele. Then an informed consent is going to basically be a form of risk stratification. An informed consent is really just going to allow the client to understand what the risks are associated with exercising, and then also basically would let the person know if they do have any issues that they should obtain a medical clearance when necessary. And then also we have the HIPAA Act, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. This is going to ensure the victim's privacy. And mainly it does this by putting them in control, or the client in control, of who has access to their personal health information. So yeah, that's really something that we've gone over in other chapters, but want to emphasize it here. And the main thing from this chapter is that the information needs to be stored in a locked file drawer to ensure protections, because you're going to be writing important medical information about your clients, and where you store that needs to be locked and secure. So a locked file cabinet in the personal training office would be most recommended. That ensures protection. All right, next we're gonna talk about the emergency assessment. So with the emergency assessment, it's really important to understand that the first thing you're going to do once you come up on a potential emergency is basically find out if it is an emergency. And the way you do that is by tapping the victim's shoulder and asking them, hey, are you okay? If there's no response, that's when you would activate the emergency medical services or basically call 911. So if they do respond, then you know there's no emergency, or there might not be an emergency, and you can talk to the person to see what's going on. Then always check for the ABCs, the airway, breathing, and circulation. Also look to see if there's severe bleeding anywhere that you need to be aware of. Then the secondary assessment is then you're going to go from the head to toe and just kind of look for things like deformities, abrasions, tenderness, swelling, or any medical alert jewelry that may indicate something is going on. Then also take the person's pulse, take the blood pressure, you know, if the situation deems necessary. All right, and then also, yeah, call 911 in life-threatening situations. Even if your client is unable to, or basically unable to respond, you're obviously calling 911, but I've had situations in which the client is just can't catch their breath, their heart rate's through the roof, in which they feel like something might be severe. So calling 911 can be even done in even potentially non-life-threatening situations if it seems severe enough. So keep that in mind. Also, anything that requires immediate medical attention, you should definitely call 911 too. All right, moving on to slide number four in the initial response, we're going to be talking about the CPR and AED. So the CPR and AED are, or CPR and AEDs are extremely important in the gym setting, as well as they are responsible for bringing back almost 80 to 90% of the people that have a heart attack. So if these two things are done and done or performed immediately and effectively, The likelihood of the person surviving goes up to 80 to 90%. Because they can restart the heart and get blood flow to the much needed areas. But CPR stands for cardiopulmonary resuscitation. Basically, ventricular fibrillation is going to be most common, the most common rhythm during cardiac arrest. Basically, the ventricle is not pumping effectively would be ventricular fibrillation. And that's basically the cessation of proper heart function. Spasmatic quivering of the heart is what that is. Too fast to allow the chambers to completely fill and empty. That's what happened to one of my clients. Their heart rate wasn't calming down and it wasn't allowing adequate blood flow. So he's feeling really dizzy. He was pale. He was clammy. And it lasted for a full hour even while he was in the ambulance and on to the hospital. But he was they were able to calm his heart rate down and he was okay. He just needed to join a medically supervised program and not work with a personal trainer at that point. He hadn't had any previous issues of this. I'd actually been working with him for 2 years and all of a sudden this thing kind of started to develop and one day it just went to that point. But always be aware of if the signs and symptoms of if someone is really going through a cardiac episode. All right, basically perform effective CPR until an AED arrives. You guys do not stop CPR at any point if the person if the person has no pulse and is not breathing. The longer you do CPR, the more the continuation of blood flow to the brain occurs and continues to provide the brain with needed nutrients to survive. If you stop CPR, within five minutes, that person will be non-responsive. So always continue CPR no matter where you are until a AED comes to the scene. Okay, and that's for anywhere in life. There's a story that was told by one of my professors about a couple that was diving off the coast of, I believe it was Mexico, and they were in a boat, and the wife suffered a heart attack about an hour and a half off land. He was able to get her to the boat and immediately started to perform CPR. That entire hour and a half boat ride back to land, he performed CPR on his wife. 30 breaths, 2 compressions, continued that in sets of 5, switched with another person. But basically this man performed it for more or less 2 straight hours. Once they got his wife to shore, they had an AED present and boom, shocked her. She came back to life, suffered 0 long-term damage and survived. Crazy, crazy, awesome story. But that's how effective CPR can be. So keep that in mind. It significantly increases the chances of survival. All right. That's why they, encourage, well, basically, it is mandatory that you have your CPR certification when working in the gym environment as a personal trainer. AED stands for Automated Electronic Defibrillation or Defibrillator, and this converts ventricular fibrillation back to a normal heart rhythm. It is ideal to use within 3 to 5 minutes. The Good Samaritan Law protects you in the sense that if you do use the AED and it hurts someone further, you are not liable because you're trying to save their life. And also the SA node or the sinoatrial node restarts when the shock is delivered. That's basically sends a signal through the autonomic nervous system to basically get the heart rhythm back on track. Dyspnea is going to be difficult or labored breathing. You might see this. This is basically someone's not able to get a full breath, not able to get a deep breath. They may be freaking out, have anxiety. Can be caused by emotional stress, asthma, airway obstruction, and heart problems. All right, moving on to slide number 5 as far as other common emergencies. So some signs of respiratory distress or dyspnea include poor movement of the chest wall, flaring of the nostrils, poor air exchange. They get pale or clammy or sweaty skin. Cyanosis, their skin color actually starts to get a little bit blue. Their nose, fingernails, fingertips, lining of the eyes start to turn a little bluish color. Other common emergencies include things like choking. Choking is basically the airway is blocked. They're unable to breathe. The victim will become oxygen deficient or what's called hypoxic. Performing the Heimlich maneuver is appropriate to do when choking or when someone is choking to dislodge the item in their airway, hopefully outward. Then asthma, you definitely want, you need to know what asthma is. It's basically going to be chronic inflammation of the airway. Asthma, most of you have probably known a friend growing up with asthma, in which they have wheezing, shortness of breath. They may even have an asthma attack in which they can't catch their breath, and emergency medication is needed. That's what the inhalers are for. And yeah, coughing is also there too. And you need to avoid triggers with someone with asthma. So I have had a few clients with asthma, and things that might trigger it are things like pollen or freshly cut grass or high winds, high heat can even trigger asthmatic events, or even extremely cold can trigger asthmatic events. So yeah, just always you need to know if your client has asthma to be aware for those sorts of things. All right, moving on to slide number 6, when we continue with common emergencies, angina pectoris. This one does tend to come up on the test, so we definitely want you to know it. But what is angina pectoris, or it's often called just angina? It is insufficient oxygen being supplied to the heart. Okay, so the a part of the heart is not getting enough oxygen via low blood flow, and there's chest pain that results in that. If somebody ever has chest pain, definitely sit them down, see if it continues, because they may be having a cardiac event. And then call 911 if anything progresses to where the chest pain continues, gets worse, or other signs and symptoms of a heart attack become present. Yeah, angina pectoris may feel like chest pressure or squeezing feeling, tightness. Maybe mistaken for heartburn or indigestion. A lot of people, that does happen. Severe heartburn can feel like chest pain that's near the heart, so that's why it's called heartburn, even though it's just acid indigestion typically. Pain can travel through the arms. That's the next trigger for a heart attack, when pain starts to travel through the arms, or through the left arm typically, neck or jaw or shoulder or stomach. Shortness of breath, nausea, and cold sweat or lightheadedness also may ensue. Common symptoms for women, obviously chest pain, or the most common symptoms for women is chest pain. And then we have another common emergency called syncope, or basically just fainting. And yeah, basically it's a temporary loss of consciousness due to lack of blood flow to the brain. The causes are from emotional stress, severe pain, dehydration, heavy sweating, overheating, exhaustion, sudden postural changes, violent coughing spells, can all basically decrease the amount of oxygen being delivered to the brain and can cause temporary fainting. All right. Slide number 7, further more common emergencies, stroke. Stroke's going to be one that gets a whole slide. Stroke is the third leading cause of death in the United States, and it's the number one leading cause of disability, meaning severe disability where the person typically cannot take care of themselves. It results from a blockage of blood, or yeah, how do I say this? Blockage in the brain of a blood vessel. There you go. Sometimes caused by an aneurysm. An aneurysm is a balloon-type bubble in the vessel in a weak spot that can rupture. Aneurysm can lead to a hemorrhage in which blood on the brain occurs. Also, a malformation of blood vessels may lead to a hemorrhagic stroke. Aneurysm is basically you're looking at a blood clot in a blood vessel to the brain. That's the main what a stroke, or that is what a stroke is. Warning signs of a stroke is things like balance is off or walking, talking, speech is slurred, reach, more or less one side is numb or weak. Then you have full or partial loss of vision, severe headaches, drooping of the face, things of that nature. Always be aware. But more common in smokers, more common in heavy drinkers, obese populations, and diabetics. People, hopefully no one's having a stroke under the age of, 40 or 50, but in the older population, you definitely want to be aware of those signs and symptoms if you plan on working with that population. So, all right, more common emergencies, we're going to talk about diabetes. Diabetes does come up in the field quite frequently. Typically, if you are working with an older population or a out of shape population, some people might be type 2 diabetic. Okay, also, youth diabetic or type 1 insulin dependent diabetes can be very common as well. I've had clients with both type 2 and type 1 diabetes. And more or less the type 1, which is insulin dependent diabetes, or youth developed diabetes, the pancreas does not make enough insulin. So you must inject or pump or inhale insulin to have normal levels of blood sugar. And it may go undiagnosed for years. So yeah, typically though is at youth onset diabetes. I guess that was the word I was looking for. Type 2 diabetes is non-insulin dependent, meaning your body is producing enough insulin and insulin secretion is normal, but the body becomes resistant to the insulin you're producing. It's basically like when somebody ding-dong ditches you, you go to the door the first time, you go to the door the second time, but the third time you're like, I don't need to go to the door anymore. That was a little, let me see if I can make that a little bit more clear. Insulin is the ding-dong ditcher in the sense that the cell in which blood sugar is trying to get into the cell is being ding-dong ditched by insulin. When insulin is present, the cell opens up. So insulin is present, the cell opens up, and usually there's glucose that the cell absorbs. But what happens in type 2 diabetes is insulin is constantly present and the cell becomes resistant, meaning the cell has had so many ding-dong ditches in the sense that the insulin knocks, the cell opens, but there's no sugar there, that the cell starts to not open up anymore. Hopefully that made a little bit more sense, but that's a good way to explain type 2 diabetes to your clients, or just a good way to understand it for sure. And then, yeah, the effects of diabetes, the main thing you're looking for in diabetics is going to be managing their blood sugar, which is preventing hypo or hyperglycemia. Hyperglycemia is going to be the blood sugar is too high, and insulin, the victim becomes weak, thirsty, and fatigued. And then hypoglycemia is when the blood sugar is too low, and the victim shows signs of headache, hunger, weakness, sweating, or fatigue. So basically, if the blood sugar is too high, they have very similar symptoms to if the blood sugar is too low. But if the blood sugar is too low, they eat some carbs. If their blood sugar is too high, they inject some sort of insulin. All right. Have a snack available for a client that is diabetic, as typically during exercise, blood sugar drops and may need to be replenished or increased. So blood glucose and exercise. One thing we do want you guys to know is that a client that is diabetic needs to have 100 milligrams per deciliter of a blood sugar level before resuming any activity or prior to exercise. And if that happens, a snack high in complex carbs and low in fat is recommended. Or if someone has 250 milligrams or higher, they should not exercise until their blood sugar is lower. That's basically the simple way of putting that. All right, looking on to slide number 9, continuing with common emergencies, heat stress. Okay, so heat stress is very common in, hot areas, we'll say for sure, but during exercise it can occur. Heat stress basically is heat exhaustion and or heat stroke. Some of the signs and symptoms for heat exhaustion include things like a weak or rapid pulse, low blood pressure, fatigue, headache, dizziness, weakness, paleness, elevated or core body temperature too high. And then heat exhaustion treatment is basically immediately stop exercise, move to a cooler area, lay down, elevate the feet 12 to 18 inches, and give fluids, cold fluids especially. Heat stroke signs and symptoms, we definitely want you to know for the test, specifically hot and dry skin, bright red skin color, labored breathing, a change in mental status are very important. Then you have a rapid and strong pulse or anxiety or extremely elevated body temperature. And then you have the treatment for heat stroke, which is going to be to stop exercise, remove clothing, cool the body temperature immediately in any way possible, give fluids, especially cold fluids. And then with heat stroke, this is probably someone where they're close to fainting or they have fainted. They need to get to an emergency room immediately. All right. Other common emergencies as we continue to slide number 10. We want you to understand that fluid intake, the recommendations come from this chapter, and we definitely want you to know this. Specifically, the fluid to replace after a specific body weight loss. But the fluid intake recommendations during exercise or just in general, include, or for exercise, we'll say, 2 hours prior to exercise, have 17 to 20 ounces of water. Every 10 to 20 minutes during exercise, have 7 to 10 ounces of water. Basically, I just say every 30 minutes, make sure you at least drink 8 ounces, or 20 minutes, especially during exercise. After exercise, the most important one probably here statistic-wise is going to be to replace fluid at a 1-to-1 ratio, or 16 to 24 ounces for every pound lost. A pound is 16 ounces, so replace 16 ounces worth of fluid for every pound loss. If a client loses 3 pounds of weight, guess how much? Yep, 48 ounces must be drank. So seizures is next. And there's different types of seizures, but you have a tonic-clonic seizure, which is also known as a grand mal. That is going to be the most common. But seizures typically occur with abnormal sign, or basically abnormal and excessive electrical activity in the brain, in which the brain kind of, we'll say, seizes and stops working efficiently, and a break is needed. What the most important thing to do for seizures, I'm currently working with a client with epilepsy, and the most important thing that is going to be for a personal trainer to do is that if a seizure occurs, and there are some telltale signs, just ask the individual for their telltale signs, but clear the area to make sure they don't hit anything. Don't try to touch the victim, more or less. Don't try to restrain the victim. Don't try to open the victim's mouth or put anything in it. And just let them have the seizure in a safe location, in a safe area. So where they can't hit anything, that's very important. All right, and then moving to our last slide as we talk about a bit of soft tissue injuries. So abrasion, just kind of listing some definitions here. An abrasion is basically going to be a scrape or a fall, like you skinned your knee. Incision is a clean cut, usually to the skin from a sharp edge. Laceration is a tear of the skin caused by a shearing force. Avulsion is a laceration which the skin is torn away. Maybe you have a flap of skin there. That's an avulsion. Puncture is a penetration by an object straight in. Fractures would be next. Fractures, more or less, just breaking a bone. Pretty simple there. But the signs are going to be deformity. Definitely pain and tenderness is present. Swelling, disfigurement. Obviously, the bone's in half. You'd probably know that. Severe weakness, loss of function, bruising, exposed bones, or the joint locked in a specific position. And then as far as the spine or neck, just always be aware of the kyphotic position and the lordotic position. Kyphotic, remember from the original chapters, is going to be the thoracic spine curves posteriorly and a rounding of the upper back. This is also maybe known as swimmer's back or hunched back. And then lordotic, the lumbar spine basically curves anteriorly or has an excessive arch or in the low back or an anterior pelvic tilt. All right, guys, that's going to be it for Chapter 16 PowerPoint. Go ahead and complete the audiobook lecture below, as well as the assignments, and then take the quiz. Keep kicking butt. We are almost at the end of all of these lectures and, chapters, I guess I should say. Anyways, I look forward to seeing you down below with the audio lectures. Cheers.